Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 75 through 77 of part 5 and chapter 78 of part 6. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the previous books in the series.
Before we start, happy 100th episode, everybody.
Yay. Happy 100.
We're here.
That's amazing. 100 episodes.
100.
That's incredible.
Now that I think about it, this is your guys' 100th. Mm. But it's not my 100th because I didn't join the show until 108, right?
No, episode 8.
Oh, episode 8. Well,
but your 100th episode.
You wouldn't
will be
on yet if you joined us at 108.
Season 1, episode 8. That's sure. That's how that works. Yeah.
Right. Yes.
So technically, my 100th episode is going to be episode 108.
We'll celebrate it then.
We'll celebrate it then. Okay.
Yeah. That episode 8 episodes from now.
I hope we're covering something good.
I don't know.
Probably we are because it's a really good book.
It is, yeah.
I'm looking now.
Let's look.
Let's get the schedule going.
Oh, you get the Prudence chapter.
No.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, my God. That's so exciting.
What a nice way to celebrate. It's like it was made for you.
That is so exciting. I'm really excited now.
Wow.
Moving on, though, to what everyone probably actually really wants to hear
about. I
know.
They're like, can you guys get on with it?
Shut the fuck up, Pools.
Mm-hmm. We are going to pick the two winners, but we were asked by a listener to share some responses we got to this contest and share some of your favorite moments. So I was thinking that we can go over some of them.
Yeah.
There are some that a lot of people said.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Important Liquids was a big favorite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a classic for a reason, you know?
It's kind of funny because up until that point, I was a little nervous leaving things like that in the episodes. Mm-hmm. And when I was editing that episode, I wasn't sure if I was going to leave it in or if I was going to take it out and leave it in the outtakes or just delete it altogether. I decided to leave it in and
people loved it.
We got so many nice responses to it that it kind of changed how I edited a little bit. You know, I'm more likely to leave in some of that nonsense.
So if people think that our nonsense has increased over the seasons, no, it was always this level of nonsense. It's just Lindsay used to edit it out. Yeah, but now it's just in there. So we've always been this ridiculous.
Yeah,
it's true.
It's true. People love the emotions closet.
Yeah, they're big fans.
That was another common answer.
That was a Pool's invention.
Was it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you came up with the emotions closet.
I mean, it belongs to all of us, really. It's joint ownership of the closet.
Pool should just have her own category for the love because the Pool's love was very high.
That's really sweet. Listen, it's because mathematically, I throw a lot of shit out there. Unhinged stuff. I'm just, you know, verbal. Some of it's going to be gold.
Verbal what?
A lot of it's going to be...
Verbal what?
Verbal
she doesn't want to say the
torrent
word.
Of
she doesn't want to say it. She doesn't want to say it.
Torrent of stuff. So like, yeah, you're going to find some gems just because of the pure volume, right? It's a numbers game.
Speaking of... Grave digging buddies, huge listener favorite moment.
Iconic.
I guess you need to come up with more jingles because you got to give the people what they want.
Yeah, the thing was that was the only tune that
was the only tune you
can come up with. I don't have any other tunes, so it would all be set to the same like melody.
Well, at least people would remember the tune.
Find a Shania song and go for it.
Oh, Now there's an idea. Cass.
Man, I feel like a detective.
I love it.
So we had a lot of people, more on the Pool's train, we had a lot of people say that your talk about porn when we covered chapter 40 of Troubled Blood was their favorite moment, which I know is especially meaningful to you.
It really, really is. I mean, that's the reason you invited me on in the first place was that specific chapter, right? Because I am so intense about it?
No.
I think it was my favorite thing that I've ever done on here. And to know that it resonated with people, it really touched me, made me have to go sit in my closet for a bit. So thank you, especially to everyone who said that, because that means a lot to me.
Also, people loved your Odyssey theory.
What I'm picking up on from that is that I need to just spend all of my time coming up with more insane theories about stuff.
a lot of people love the reactions episodes.
Yes.
I think this is probably the response we got the most. And it made me really happy because so many people said it was exactly what they needed after the emotions they were feeling after finishing the book.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Catharsis.
So many people said that they don't have real people to talk to about it in real life, and listening to us just completely lose our minds is just what they needed. And that's exactly what I had hoped to do with these reactions episode. It's cathartic for us too. Yep. So that was really nice to read. Mm-hmm.
Let it all out. Because it's a lot.
We got a lot of emotions.
If only we had somewhere to stick them.
Exactly.
A few people said Ken saying the camel putting their heads in the sand was their favorite moment. That made me laugh.
You know, it lessens the embarrassment somehow, knowing that it has made people laugh so much.
To be fair, it was really fucking funny. Like, it was pretty
absolute
funny. Classic. I gotta do a cartoon of a camel putting its head in the sand.
Yeah, please do.
Do it.
Actually, I think I'm gonna fire up Midjourney right now.
Oh my gosh. Thank you to everyone who said their favorite thing is us gushing over Strike and Robin's relationship and thirsting over Strike. We do get some vocal opinions sometimes that people don't like that, but we won't stop. Can't stop, won't stop. So
won't stop.
That's kind of our brand.
We're just talking about how we feel.
If we didn't do that, it wouldn't be this show.
So yeah, those were always fun to get because I enjoy that bit too.
Yep. It's one of the most fun bits.
And just the amount of people who said that listening to us is like talking to friends about the books. That's what we hoped for when we decided to do this in the first place. We know that there are a lot of really smart people in this fandom, and I don't claim to be one of them, but making the podcast feel to listeners like they're with friends discussing books we all love, it's a wonderful thing to hear. So thank you for that.
Yeah. It is. Makes me feel like I have friends.
Oh, what's that like? I was just going to say that for me personally, there was one email that really stood out to me. I'm not going to read it or share anything about it, but to the person who chose me telling the story of learning that we were getting the Ritz in Blackheart as I was going into my C-section, I want you to know that I definitely saw that email and loved it. It was especially meaningful. I do plan on writing you back when the contest is over.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any emails in particular that stood out to you?
I did have one that made me laugh. This person who agreed with me in not hating any literary characters more than Tempest and Hartella. Feeling validated by my hatred.
I'm with you on Tempest.
And then joining me on the journey of what it means for ourselves and feeling deeply uncomfortable with that emotional exploration. To you, I see you. I feel you. We are the same. If we're both doing this, would we hate each other in real life, or would we love each other in real life?
Good question.
Like, that's the question, right? So that one I liked. Thank you to this person. You know who you are.
I have one. I wanted to read actually this whole email because it was really great. And she came up with a deep cut favorite moment that I really enjoy.
Okay.
All right. So this message is from Alexa. Dear Kens, Lindsay, and Pools, congrats on 100 episodes and heartfelt thank you for all of your passion, dedication, insight, and enthusiasm to this series. I stumbled onto this podcast in my hangover haze after The Running Grave this fall and binged the entire series since then. I've got 4 little kids, and listening to y'all while cooking, cleaning, driving, or decompressing has been a joy and a pleasure.
Aww.
I don't know how to pick a favorite moment. The first thing that pops in my head is the iconic grave-digging buddies, which I may or may not hum to myself now. I love the awkward feelings about farts and bodily noises. Same. Sorry. Girl. Same. I can't remember if it was important fluids or important liquids, but that made me chuckle. Do your guests count? Because they're always great fun. The whole conversation about mushy peas slayed me. I'm team mushy peas, by the way. They're yummy. That is my favorite one. That was from whenever we had Clara from Denmark Street Deep Dive on.
Yeah.
And I spontaneously asked her what she thought about mushy peas. And she said that mushy peas were a product of the devil's testicles.
I do remember that.
I don't even remember that.
You weren't on yet.
That's so deep, I wasn't even here yet.
And I think that she was the only one who mentioned that one. So shout out to Alexa for that one, because that's also one of my favorite moments. But anyway, moving on. And thankfully, it's not one specific moment, but a recurring and welcome treat. Visits to the emotions closet, trademark.
Yeah.
My husband, bless him, doesn't read. And as much as my mom and sister love the series, they don't analyze it and dwell over it like I do. These characters live in and consume my thoughts way more than is healthy. And you guys seem to operate the same way.
Yeah.
Having that virtual bond with you three has been wonderful these past few months. And I feel bad it's so one-sided because it seems like I benefit from this podcast way more than you do.
Aww.
I'm right there with you, fangirling with all of the feels in the emotions closet. Trademark.
Now you're giving us feels.
To wrap up Alexa's email, she says, truly, thank you for your precious time for this podcast. I know you're all busy and the time it takes to read, reflect, record, and edit isn't minimal. The three of you vibe perfectly. It's a delightful mix of humor, passion, levity, seriousness, analysis, guesswork, and investigation. In short, I love it all. Cheers, Alexa.
Oh, okay.
Aww. That was one of my favorite emails.
Yeah, that's so nice.
That was very
Thanks,
sweet.
Alexa. How sweet. Thank you.
I know. Can I read a funny... I'm not going to read this whole email because it's long, but there's this one part from Maddie. Some honorable mentions. The episode which led to the outtakes of Pools repeatedly calling her husband Strike.
Beautiful.
That was one of my favorite outtakes.
That was funny.
Okay, so Pools repeatedly calling her husband Strike and leaving the mic accidentally mid-sentence had me in tears laughing along with you. And I've literally just listened to episode 22 for The Running Grave, and I had to stop and fan myself when Kurt predicted that Robin and Cormoran would get married by the sea. Mm-hmm. My soul exited my body. This message is coming to you from my ghost. No, that was really funny.
R.I.P. I'll join you in the beyond. Mm.
Here's another little nice bit. This one's from Heather. Honestly, I listen to your podcast every single week to hear your in-depth, careful discussion of these books and characters that we have all grown to care for so much, especially the shippy stuff. I don't know if I've ever been as invested in two characters' love story in a book or series as I am with Strike and Robin. Listening to you all discuss it each week help fills the hole left in between each book when I can't seem to find anything quite as satisfying to read or watch as the Strike series.
Aww.
Same.
Y'all are going to make me cry. I wish we could just read out every book.
I know.
They're all so nice and so great. And I loved every single one of them.
Me too.
And I wish that I could have every email win.
Me too.
Giveaway.
Okay, so let's plug in these. How do I screen share? Oh, the big green button that says
share screen. Share.
No, yes. That can't be it.
Okay, I'm copying, pasting all of the entries. All
right.
Here we go. This website is commentpicker.com.
Nice.
Okay, so all the entries have been plugged in. We are also going to email the winner to confirm this because some listeners have the same first name and last initial. If you are the winner, we will also send you an email. You'll get it from us. We'll put TSEF100 winner in the subject line.
Yes.
And we are going to do the official Cuckoo's Calling 10th anniversary edition first. Okay. Are you guys ready?
Drum roll.
Yes. Drum roll.
Drum roll and post because I'm not.
That works. Okay, here we go. I'm going to hit start. Oh my God, I'm nervous. Okay. Brittany S.
Hey!
Yay!
Brittany S. Brittany. Congratulations. The official Cuckoo's Calling special edition.
Yes, mm-hmm. Brittany S. Okay. And now we're going to pick another winner for the Rolling Library Cuckoo's
another
Calling edition.
Roll?
Ready? Here we go. Start. Right. Da, 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 da. Heather D.
Heather!
Yay!
Heather D.
Heather.
Congratulations. That's so exciting.
Congratulations.
Oh, I'm so happy.
That's so great. Congratulations, Brittany. Congratulations, Heather.
Yes.
You are our winners.
Yay.
For the first ever giveaway. We'll have to do another one at some point, right?
I know.
Now I'm searching. I like this one. Brittany's favorite moment was when I had an existential crisis over being compared to Kath Kent. She has had feelings over that as well.
What was Heather's?
Aww. The only one who wanted Strike to be real. The only one who wanted Robin to be her bestie. And then I found you and I felt like I found my tribe. That's so cute. Favorite episode is Damn It, Barkley. Favorite moments from that podcast are when Clara does her readings. So good. They were good. The Damn It, Barkley episode was the only time I knew exactly why the episode had that name.
Yeah.
God damn it, Barkley. God damn it.
That's so great. I'm so excited.
I'm so happy. Mm-hmm. So happy for the two of you.
Well, that was so fun.
That was fun. Happy 100th episode, everybody.
Yay.
Thank you for participating. Thank you for all your beautiful emails. I was not expecting
me either.
Paragraphs of love from everyone. It was really, really, really sweet.
It was lovely.
And you're all winners of my books.
All right. Should we go to our Q&A?
Oh, yeah. There's an episode to record?
I know.
Really?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So the Q&A for this episode is, how does having a bigger team impact the dynamic between Strike and Robin when it was just the two of them to begin and now we're seeing more and more?
I personally, I love having the expanded agency. As they become more successful, they simply can't cover everything on their own, obviously. So from a practical point of view and a realism point of view, subcontractors have to come in. But it's fun to play with the interpersonal dynamics. Midge is a character I absolutely love. She's obviously, in this book, the only other female detective on the team. She's very resourceful. I find her a lot of fun to write. She's pretty feisty. She's also very direct with Strike in a way that he's direct with others. And that's fun to play with, because although Robin and Strike have certainly rowed, she probably wouldn't go where Midge goes during a row. So it brings out aspects of Strike and Robin's characters, having them interact with this bunch of subcontractors. And I really enjoy that.
All right. When she talks about Midge being the only other female detective in this book, do you think that means we might get another one?
Yeah, I think we might. The phrasing feels like a definite clue, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because there's never been another woman. So it's not like she's talking about a previous book.
Yeah.
I'm on to you, Joe.
Mm-hmm. Unless Nutley had a big secret. Because of his name. Oh, sorry. But I feel like we need one more permanent contractor so that the agency hits that magic 7 number, including Pat, obviously. And another woman would make it even, basically.
I love the idea of having another female detective. That would be so much fun.
Same.
You know, I don't know if I like Joe calling Midge feisty, because Anna Kiara calls me feisty all the time, and it's not great for me. You know? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, I'm going to sip my wine and zip my lips over here.
Okay. Okay.
You feisty? Never.
No, I'm not. No, not feisty. Never.
No one would call you feisty.
No, you guys don't see my halo?
Propped up by devil horns.
I still think I'm very different than her. It's just fine. It's fine.
Well, I think I'm different from Hartella, so.
Catherine Kent.
And Kath Kent, but apparently not. But seriously, I agree with Joe here that Midge is a great character. I mean, yeah, okay. She has flaws. All the best characters do. It's what makes them interesting. And you know what? She's always fun. Her lines are hilarious. She has a super strong personality that's memorable on page. She adds like some conflict and friction to the dynamic. I'm a fan. Joe loves Midge. I love Midge.
I still want to love Midge.
Do you? You could be trying harder to love Midge. You could be putting a bit more effort in, you know, if she really wanted to.
She just makes me tired. That's all.
Yeah.
When she talks about the subcontractors bringing out aspects of Strike and Robin's characters, what do you think they bring out in each of them?
Ooh. I feel like Midge is frustrating for Strike, but she also serves as like
relatable,
kind of funhouse mirror, because she's similar to him in some ways, which I'm not imagining because Joe says it right there. So she brings out his temper, right? And his sort of, I give orders, I have them obeyed military background. He's used to doing that. He's not used to people like insubordinating him, right? She is a trial for him. And it's funny. And I love her.
She's a trial for me as well.
Yeah. But in terms of the other contractors, Barclay, I think, brings out the bro in Strike. You know, like their banter.
Yeah.
Sherlock Big Cock, Tartan 12 Inch. They bring out the bro.
Yeah. They bring out the bromance.
Dev, I think we need to see more of Dev to judge. He's been like sort of the Overwatch on Strike, like the slightly judgy angel on his shoulder, making sure he's not.
He kind of watches out for Strike.
Yeah, but he does watch out for Strike.
But what does he bring out in Strike? I'm not sure yet.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. For Robin, Barclay obviously brings out her shovel and flashlight and knife.
Well, naturally.
But I sense in their dynamic that when he's around, she gets to have a bit more silly fun than she usually does. I might be imagining it, but the stuff like them talking about the Al-Qaeda cards, and he gives her a pack and she laughs about it, and him calling her a numpty, it just, it seems like she gets to be a bit silly with him. But I could be imagining that. We don't get enough of them. I want more. I also want to see more Robin with Midge, because I feel like she admires and respects Midge in a lot of ways and wants to be like that kind of really badass, tough woman. And there isn't the same friction there that there is a Strike.
Mm-hmm.
Midge obviously really cares about Robin with how worried she is in the next set of chapters, right? I need more of Robin interacting with all of the subcontractors. I guess her being away for 4 months in this book really put a damper on that bit.
Yeah, you know what I'm really curious about with Robin and the subcontractors is if she had to take a disciplinary role,
Yeah.
We don't ever see that with these three, with the three that they're permanent and that they get along with. It's like Strike is the parent who has to do the disciplining, you know, and then Robin's the fun parent. And that's not fair.
I think Strike likes, I think Strike is happy to.
I'm joking. Yeah. I'm just kind of curious because I feel like that would be hard for her.
Yeah. She might have. Well, we saw how she was with Morris. She gave him way too much leeway. Mm-hmm.
And that's with someone she doesn't like.
Yeah.
That's with someone she doesn't like. If it's someone she does like and normally gets along with well, but she's also their boss, I'd be really interested to see that. That might actually be a strength of Strike's.
100%. I'd like to see that too, actually.
Yeah.
But with this set, they're all so great that you don't need to do anything with them.
Well, except for when Midge does things like what she does.
Well, she doesn't do that to Robin because there isn't that friction there. Anyway, I love all these characters. I want to see more of them. I too love the dynamic of the growing agency. It's so much fun.
It is.
And it's so different from like the lone noir detective.
He's not alone anymore. He has a team.
He has a family. A work family.
All right. Should we jump into chapter 75?
Yes, we should. In chapter 75, Strike discovers the real reason for Little John's odd behavior. And then the epigraph goes, "Thus the superior man controls his anger and restrains his instincts." And that is from hexagram 41. Decrease.
This is definitely speaking to Strike controlling his anger with Little John and restraining his instinct to fire him immediately.
This hexagram, and we've seen this one before recently, it's the one that's about the transfer of wealth and power from below to above.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's sort of what's happening here because Strike is taking power back from Little John. He's putting him in his place and he's getting that control back.
Yeah.
And the judgment for this line says, "The lake at the foot of the mountain evaporates. In this way, it decreases to the benefit of the mountain, which is enriched by its moisture. The mountain stands as a symbol of a stubborn strength that can harden into anger. The lake is a symbol of unchecked gaiety that can develop into passionate drives at the expense of the life forces." And I'm like, that's kind of a good image for this conversation, right? The lake is Little John. His gaiety, aka gambling, has become an obsession that's gotten him into trouble. And he's now evaporated because he's been caught. And Strike, the stubborn strength hardened into anger, is enriched by this knowledge that Little John is willing to give up to try and save his own ass.
Yeah.
I feel like the image works, not just because I want to think of Strike as a mountain.
Which also works.
We open the chapter with Barclay asking Strike for his opinion on Robin's latest letter, and surprising no one, Strike says it's time for her to come out.
Yes, it is.
Very much.
I get the feeling that Barclay was hoping Strike would say that.
Yeah.
He immediately agrees. He mentions Robin being sexually assaulted by Wace. Mm-hmm. I think we're all feeling it.
We're all well past feeling it at this point. I definitely got the sense that Barclay was worried about Robin, which is really sweet to me. He waited at the door while Strike read the letter so that they could confer because he cares about her.
They're grave digging buddies for life.
Best friends for life.
No, they're not best friends though.
Well, okay. It's a song. It's artistic license.
They're work friends for life. That's what you should have said.
Fine. Work friends for life. Retroactively go back and edit.
We should.
Don't you dare.
I'm just saying.
So after Barclay mentions the sexual assault, it says, Strike said nothing, dropping his eyes again to the last few lines of Robin's letter. "And Wace groped me. He didn't get far because Mazu and Becca came in."
I can only imagine what was going through his head. Probably a mixture of anger, sadness, worry. Probably really wanted to punch Jonathan Wace.
Yeah.
Here, I think, is where Strike is having the first serious inklings that maybe he underestimated the actual danger to Robin in this place. I'm flashing back to the conversation about spirit bonding before she went under. Remember how calmly she said, "If it comes down to attempted rape, I'll leave and go to the police."
Feels so long ago.
So long ago. And now it's come down to actual sexual assault, which I'm certain would have escalated if they hadn't been interrupted. And she has not left.
They had no plan for what to do if she couldn't leave.
No plan.
I mean, it had to be that way because it's a book and we need the drama, right? But
yeah,
they didn't have a plan for this. Robin's letter asked for another week. Realistically, she's going to get another week, right? Because they can't arrange it with her until she reads the next letter, right? So I'm guessing she's just asking him to not come and storm the castle or something.
Yes, I imagine she's trying to head that off at the pass because, I mean, I'm sure she knows exactly what Strike and even Barclay's response to hearing that Wace has assaulted her is going to be.
Yeah.
But if she thinks that Strike isn't going to insist that she comes out immediately with her next letter, then she's dreaming. Like she says, 1 week might do it.
I know, Robin.
Girl, you better count your minutes because the second that this week is up, Strike is battering down this front door. and you're mm-hmm. out. He's right? not letting you stay in any longer. Sorry,
absolutely
baby girl.
Not. Yeah, torches, pitchfork, the whole yep. damn cavalry if he has to.
Yep.
There's a whole paragraph where Strike is worrying about Robin, and it really stressed me out. Mm. Robin is now witness to something horrible with Lynn. She's compromised herself again by telling them about the plants. And yeah. now she's stuck in there, and he's sitting here staring at all these pictures of these people who have died or disappeared in connection with the UHC.
Yeah. And he doesn't even know about the slip she's had with her name. And
I know.
In the woods. Like, can you imagine? But when Strike says he hadn't anticipated Robin hanging around afterwards, it's like, my man, my bro. Have you met your Robin? Because the job isn't 100% done. She hasn't got Will out. Of course she's hanging around to finish it at the expense of her own safety and well-being.
He didn't bank on Robin having a secret saving people thing.
I feel like it's not so secret at this point that she has that.
It's no, not. Maybe not.
I get what he means. They wanted yeah. evidence against the church to be able to go to the police with, not necessarily get Will out. But
yeah, but seriously though, he doesn't even hear Barclay speaking to him at first because he's so busy worrying about Robin.
I love the next bit though when Barclay's so cheerful about Strike firing Little John and wants to stay to watch. It's like he got to watch Morris get fired. He just wants a round two for fun.
He's earned it. Too bad he couldn't stay. Although this firing, it's not as good as the last time. There's no broken noses.
Well, no one gets fired.
No one gets fired even. So anticlimactic. Right. There's no dick pic revelations, no Strike stepping forward menacingly.
I'm very glad Little Dawn didn't send Strike a dick pic.
We're all very thankful.
I think we're all very thankful for that, yeah. I'd imagine that Barclay would have much the same feelings about Little Dawn crying as Strike does.
Yeah, I mm-hmm. think so. He would have expressed them.
Yeah, their debrief would have been the funniest banter trashing Little John ever.
I like to think that Barclay gets as much of a kick out of Strike putting crappy subcontractors in their place as much as we do.
100% he does, yeah. I get the sense that Barclay basically just lives his whole life enjoying the show with a bowl of popcorn, which is a vibe that I completely respect. Do you think he tells his wife all about whatever drama is going down at the agency? Does she demand updates on whatever ridiculous pining glances Strike and Robin are throwing each other? I kind of like to imagine the Barclays low-key shipping it together and being like, oh, these dummies.
I'd like to think both Barclay and Dev tell their wives what's going on.
Yeah.
Pat called me a Scottish nutter again today. Something like that. And I know I'm in the unpopular minority here, but yeah. I am still not sure Barclay knows or suspects anything between Strike and Robin. Mm. I'm not saying it's a for sure no, he might. I just don't think there's any evidence in the book so far that suggests he does.
Yeah.
At least we get that look from Pat at the end that suggests it, but I don't think we have anything like that for Barclay.
Let's get to the confrontation with Little John. Mm. When Strike confronts him with a photo of him walking into Patterson's office, Little John then starts to cry.
I don't know about you guys, but this was awkward for me to read.
Totally. Yeah.
It was similar to Bijou crying, where the person who caused all of their own problems is now crying to Strike to fix it. It's kind of hard to feel sympathetic. At least with Bijou, she was pregnant. I can understand being emotional when your hormones are all over the place in the beginning of a pregnancy, but something tells me Little John doesn't have that excuse.
No, not at all.
I love this line. If Strike had been asked to rank everyone he'd witnessed crying recently, according to how much sympathy he felt for their distress, he'd have given Bijou last place without hesitation. Now, however, he realized that there was a category of weeper he despised even more than a woman who'd played a duplicitous game that had been blown up in her face. A man who'd done his best to take down another person's business, destroy that person's reputation, undermine an investigation into men stalking a woman, and cause that woman additional fear and alarm, all of which he'd presumably done for money, but who now seemed to expect pity for being found out.
Mm. This is just so purely Strike.
Yes.
We know he's not self-pitying. We know he'd never do what Little John did to Tasha.
Never.
He would never cause anyone, particularly a woman, fear like that. He would never try to destroy someone else. Little John is just everything Strike is not. In the worst way possible.
Exactly that. I love how much emphasis Strike is putting on what Little John did to Tasha. Yeah. He's taking that just as serious as Little John attacking him, if not more so.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think I remember calling Little John a much less likable version of Strike before finishing the book. It's like he's an incompetent, morally bankrupt, and humorless version of him.
So nothing like him.
Yeah.
Aside from looking grumpy and being clean cut, I think that's probably the only things that they share in common.
Yeah.
How did the revelation that Patterson was using Little John's gambling debt to get Little John to spy on Strike make you feel better or worse towards Little John?
I get the shitty situation that he's in for sure. And yes, it's true that you're not defined by your mistakes. However, I think that you are defined by how you choose to react to them. And that bit that Pools just read a moment ago, I feel like really sums up perfectly why it's hard to feel sympathy for him, even with the crappy circumstances that he finds himself in.
Yeah, I've got to be real. I don't feel too much sympathy for him at all. Now that I think about it, though, could there be a little foreshadowing here with, okay, bear with me, someone's addiction getting them into trouble that puts them under the thumb of a bad actor and makes them do illegal or immoral things? You picking up what I'm putting down here?
No.
I'm talking about Murphy's past.
Oh, okay.
Where he was drinking. Maybe something happened back then that's hanging over his head and has led him into being blackmailed to be a crooked cop or something. I know that it's a crazy theory. I know that it's soap opera dramatic. I don't care. I'm here for it.
Okay.
I know it's not likely before everyone comes at me. I'm aware.
All right. This next thing that Little John says is really fun. And he's talking about Patterson here.
Yeah.
He's got a real fucking thing about you, said Little John, trying to stem the stream of snot from his nose. He's an old mate of Roy Carver's. He blames you for Carver getting forced out, and it pisses him off you get all the publicity. And clients want you, not him.
I know what you're going to say.
You know what
did
I'm
you,
saying?
Did you
say
have
it.
The same brainwave
that I just had the just same
did?
Brainwave as you just
the
did.
Snot?
The snot.
Yes.
Parallel with Robin doing
I
it.
I know.
Oh, why didn't we catch that, right?
The snot parallel.
It fits. Yeah. Maybe we should like elaborate for people who don't share our brains.
Right. We both just at the same moment, I saw the look on your face, thought yeah. Little John trying to wipe the snot is like Robin doing it.
Wiping it all over her face to try and manipulate. Like, to...
Little John's trying to manipulate Strike.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is this telling us that all these tears are fake? Because Robin's were fake.
Oh,
what
then.
Do you think?
No.
Is that way too?
No, I believe it. It's crocodile tears. Fuck mm-hmm. this guy. He's full of shit.
He says you're taking all his business. He was really fucked off about Colin Enzer sacking us and coming here instead.
I can't help but notice that Little John says us when talking about Patterson.
I caught that too. I think it's a bit of a subconscious slip about how he really sees himself. No matter yeah. what he's blubbing to Strike about how much better he likes working for him. Like,
mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm.
we see through you, Little John, and your little crocodile tears.
I wonder if Mitch has ever considered, I don't know, maybe being a better detective. Maybe then the agency wouldn't be taking all of his clients. A novel no. idea.
I mean, this might sound cheesy, but given that Patterson's a bit shady himself, I don't think it's possible for him to be as good as the person who cares so much about justice. He's mm-hmm. not driven by a passion for the job the way Strike is, and likely doesn't have as much experience or intelligence either. But mm-hmm. I do believe that the more you care, the better you'll be.
Very mm-hmm. true. Also, the nerve of Little John trying to throw Pat under the bus here. The audacity of him. How dare you, sir? How dare mm-hmm. you? But I love how clearly Strike sees what he's doing. It says, Strike was pleased to learn that ratting other people out was Little John's preferred strategy for getting out of messes. Much could be done with such a man. Mm-hmm. And yeah, note how he does it again in just a minute with Midge. Did he never learn about what happens to snitches?
You know, Strike should have given him some stitches.
I was pleased that Pat had already confessed this to Strike because I wouldn't yeah. have wanted any moment of pause where Strike was caught off guard by the news that she's 67. Mm-hmm. He would have said, she's 67 what? You know? But very interesting about Roy Carver. It feels like such a waste of Patterson's time and energy, even if Carver was an old friend, you know?
I really liked this callback to Carver here. Mm-hmm. It kind of figures that they're old friends. Totally tracks.
Birds of a feather.
And I'm so glad that he got forced out of the police because he was an incompetent dickhead.
But going back to how obsessed he is with it, now bear with me here.
I get nervous every time you say it.
Maybe they were actually secret lovers, but could never be open about their relationship because of that old school homophobic boys club, right?
Oh boy.
Right? Yeah. But it does feel like Carver's been lurking in the background waiting for his revenge this whole time. He seems like he's going off the rails and becoming like a really incompetent, useless supervillain.
There's the title for Strike and Ellicott Book 9, Carver's yeah. Revenge.
That'd be good.
I'm surprised by how many people want Carver back.
He was so much fun to hate. He's such a dickhead.
I just don't know if I see it.
I think the mention of him is enough. I don't think we need more.
No.
But I suppose that Carver being forced out would have meant that Patterson lost his good contact within the police, which we know would have been pretty rough for him to lose. And then add on, as he says, all the richest clients choosing Strike because he's the best.
Probably a lot sexier too. Oh,
so much sexier.
That's an important quality in a private investigator. Yeah.
The jealousy makes sense. Patterson doesn't seem like the smartest guy on the block. So maybe he's like, oh, if I take down Strike, my business is totally going to rebound and I'll be the best detective agency in London.
I mean, jealousy makes sense, but he's spending a lot of money on this. You know, invest in being better at your job. It's such a weird obsession. At this point, he's more obsessed with Strike than I am.
What?
Damn.
I don't think that's possible.
I'm just saying, he's like
certain
Harry Potter fan sites who hate a certain someone but can't stop tweeting about her. Just saying.
That's the same energy.
It's the same energy, yeah.
Same energy.
If Patterson blamed Strike for Carver getting fired, something had to have happened after Lang was caught, right?
Yeah. I'm guessing it was basically like a retire or you're fired situation with how much he'd fucked up the cases.
I feel like there's only so many times you can royally fuck up high profile cases and make the Met a laughingstock before they say, all right, enough is enough.
He probably had fuck ups before then, let's be real. He's not that great.
Do you believe Little John when he says he prefers working for Strike?
Well, I can't imagine that Patterson is a better boss than Strike is, because we know from Dev that he uses his employees to go after people in his own personal vendettas, right? Now that I say that, who has he done this to besides Strike? Because it's got to be someone if Dev had to do this.
Yeah.
I've also just now realized that that bit from Dev in Ink Blackheart was foreshadowing for this whole plot.
Oh, yeah. Didn't Dev also say that sometimes he wouldn't pay them back for their expenses or something like that, too?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember that. I'd be pissed about that, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if he actually enjoys working for Strike more than Patterson. Mm-hmm. It might be possible, but honestly, it's too little too late now.
Yeah.
Little John says he can be helpful to Strike, and then Strike asks him about the woman who isn't a stalker, and then we get confirmation that she does, in fact, work for Patterson.
This was a huge relief for me that she wasn't a UHC person, and we learned that she's the one who bugged Hanwold's office.
You know, that was a relief for me as well. I was less worried about Patterson and his lackeys than I was about the UHC.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't worried at all. I don't know if that's because Patterson is just laughable compared to Strike, or if all of my worry was back in the UHC with Robin and I had none left to spare.
I had no idea that your capacity for anxiety had a limit.
The limit does not exist.
It probably doesn't, but in this situation, in this case, maybe. It does. Yeah. That's how bad the UHC.
You've reached your threshold.
You're up to here with
Joe has finally done it. She has found my threshold for anxiety. Nobody knew it could be done.
But speaking of Patterson trying to get out of trouble by throwing other people under the bus, when Strike implies that they're done and Little John's going to be fired, this is when he shows Strike the pictures of Midge and Tasha Mayo. One picture is of Midge and Tasha outside her home carrying shopping bags, and the other is Midge leaving Tasha's house in the evening.
First of all, Little John going to give this to Patterson is so gross and pathetic.
Yeah.
I was going to try and screw you over again, but since I have to show you this.
Right?
I'm not as bad as I could have been. Give me a gold star.
Only because I have to.
Yeah, that would not have worked out well.
Why did he think saying I was planning on showing this to Patterson was going to help him in any way?
Because he is stupid.
That's not smart.
So when that doesn't work on Strike, Little John says that he has a recording of Kevin that Patterson never turned in.
I like the subtle way this tells us that Little John isn't that great of a detective, with the fact that he doesn't even remember Kevin's last name. Out of everyone at the agency, Little John has had this case for a lot longer since he worked on it for years with Patterson too, right? Yeah. He can't even remember the names of the people involved, especially a person who was killed during their investigation.
Oh my God, you're right. I didn't realize that. Maybe if Little John had actually been more chatty, Strike would have realized that he was a shit detective so much earlier and gotten rid of him without even knowing about the mole stuff.
That's why he kept his mouth shut.
That's why he keeps his mouth shut, because he's incompetent.
Yeah. It kind of also shows that Patterson isn't that great either. Not that we needed more evidence of this, but there is actually a lot of good information on that recording. It's just kind of hard to sort through.
Yeah.
And it's so funny when Little John says kind of the same thing. Yeah, but it's you, isn't it? Said Little John, desperate. You can do something with it.
God. Well, at least Little John has the sense to recognize the superior detective when he sees him.
Yes. He can sense that big detective energy.
We all can.
Oh, yeah.
He can't have it, but he can sense it.
Mm-hmm.
This attempt at flattery makes Strike even more mad, as it should. But he agrees that if Little John brings in that recording, they can have another talk about his employment.
I do admit that I feel a teensy bit bad that Little John is getting false hope here, when actually Strike has absolutely zero intention of keeping him employed. I mean, I don't feel too bad, but a little bad.
Yeah. Turns out that Little John is not the only person who has the capability of being shady and duplicitous.
Yeah, but Strike is sexier when he does it.
Much.
Yeah. I mean, I get what you're saying, but the man did put a snake through a client's door who was being stalked. Yeah. If he genuinely thinks that Strike is going to let him keep working there, then he's as stupid as he is shady. Because Strike had to get that tape.
Definitely.
Yeah. And it turns out that Little John is, in fact, as stupid as he is shady.
It sure does.
Now, let's get to this good part where Strike calls Midge and is angry about her and Tasha Mayo.
The Midge thing. This is something that does confuse me because I don't understand some of the reactions to it. I know Strike later says that he overreacts here, but I think he's right to be concerned. I don't think he's wrong about how the press could spin this. This would be, and probably really did become, a high-profile case when it all came out. This would be fascinating news, right?
Oh, yeah.
I can imagine. If Little John had given Patterson those photos, I think that that's exactly what Patterson would have done with it and would have spun it to whatever journalist he sold them to. I'm sure he has shady journalist contacts who would have no problem making that suggestion.
I guess I just don't see why it would look so bad, even with whatever spin. Because if it's a high profile case, it means that it's known that the agency was the one helping Tasha. It's not like they're photos of two women having sex. Literally just one statement from Tasha that the agency both tracked her stalkers and provided personal protection to keep her safe. And the agency looks even better. They come out of it looking amazing. I just don't think these photos would be a huge deal.
Yeah, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. I think that given that later on in the same book, Strike and Robin have to deal with the potential fallout of being labeled on Wikipedia as having inappropriately close relationships with their clients, I don't think that we're meant to underestimate the potential impact that that could have. Strike is for sure overreacting here because he's projecting his own worries about Bijou onto this, but I don't think that he's necessarily in the wrong to worry about it because people can make statements all they want, but it won't stop people from speculating. And that in and of itself could be damaging. I mean, look at the stuff with Kate Middleton. Bottom line, I think that it could call the integrity of the entire agency into question. And that is worth being worried about.
Yeah, I agree with you, Kenz. There's that moment earlier where Charlotte said that she had told a journalist that she didn't think he'd ever slept with a client. It seems like at least one journalist is after that angle, and the pictures suggest more than a client-investigator relationship. So I think it's possible this could have blown over if it did get out, but I don't think it's a non-issue to not be concerned about at all.
I mean, he did sleep with an interviewee who could have turned out to be a murderer. Kara Porter could totally have murdered Lula because she was her best friend. She's got to be a suspect.
Sure, but how many years ago was that at this point?
Yeah, a few.
He had like nothing. He was not in the news. Yeah. He has a completely different perspective.
Yes, he does.
I'm also just going to say that Midge's response here about Bijou was, in my opinion, so out of line. I cannot imagine ever saying that to a boss and expecting to keep my job.
100%. Oh my God. I literally gasped when I read that, because that was too. Way below the belt.
It was funny though. I didn't find this funny at all. Like, this is the kind of thing where I'm just not with me. Like, I don't think that this is funny. Bijou was a dumb move, but I don't think it's a really fair comparison because she had nothing to do with their work or business. Expecting him to anticipate what would have happened is not the same thing as what Midge is doing.
He does think that he knew she was mouthy and indiscreet and yet slept with her a second time, though. So he knew that there was a danger of it getting out.
He's not sleeping with a client.
No. Well, neither is Midge at this point.
Sure.
And she was so upset because he just insinuated she was.
I don't think he was.
He absolutely insinuated that to her.
When?
Asking what they were doing in the house when she was having coffee. Like,
I think that he's implying that they're getting too friendly. What is she doing in the house is a totally fair question.
Oh, I 100% read that as him insinuating. And I think Midge read that in that too with her response.
Maybe.
She said, what are you saying?
I think he's totally allowed to ask that question. She is not supposed to be inside. So why can't he ask the question? She's not supposed to be inside her house.
I mean, I mean, he was absolutely insinuating they were having sex, though.
I don't think that he was. I think that is a completely fair question to ask. Midge is not supposed to be in her house. He's perfectly in line asking, what is she doing in the house?
Okay. We have a different read on that. But I think Midge read it that he was insinuating that they'd slept together. That's why she's so offended by it.
I mean, I think the fact that she's upset that she got caught doing it, I think she knows that she wasn't supposed to be talking with Tasha inside her house. And she's like, who showed you? And then she's mad at Little John.
So she's projecting her guilt. Yeah.
Yeah. She knows that she's not supposed to be doing this.
Okay. I mean, yeah. Guilty conscience. But I don't think they were sleeping together at this point. Do you think that they were?
No.
Because I believed Midge when she said that they weren't.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
But I do think that they were getting over familiar with what, that's what he said. Yeah, I do.
Okay. Fair enough.
I was just going to say, Shrike's response when he says, I'll pretend I didn't hear that. That's Jack's new thing.
Oh, is it?
He says that to me. And the first time I was like, excuse me? But then the second time he said it, I said, I'm going to pretend even harder that you heard me really well. And he was so caught off guard.
Oh,
that's a good comeback. Parents of the Month Award over here.
That he just started laughing and it ruined his whole bad mood. It was so funny.
Oh, you
win. I don't think it would have worked with Strike, though, if Midge had said that.
No.
Maybe not, but I'm imagining it. It's hilarious.
It would have been great, yeah.
But it's so fucking funny.
The stuff about how the press might spin this was far less concerning to me, though, than Midge potentially being spotted by the Franks.
Mm.
This popped into my head immediately. I think that this is the more serious screw-up on her part. The photo with her helping Tasha with her bags, why was she close enough that it would have looked weird not to help her? Because in my mind, she should be across the street or something blending in. It's not really clear if she was watching the Franks watch Tasha or just watching Tasha's house and the Franks were somewhere else, right? I'm not sure which of the two. So one is definitely worse than the other, right? But
yeah,
my biggest concern was that the Franks saw her with Tasha one of the times and Midge wasn't aware.
I mean, in this case, she didn't necessarily have been close. And I'm just grasping at any straw because I'm on the Midge defense squad. She said that she was chasing tins all over the road. I would cross the road to help another woman whose bag split if shit was rolling everywhere. Absolutely. And I think it was weird if someone just stood there not doing it. But depending on the layout of the street and like the car access, the best place to keep an eye out for the Franks could have been closer to the supermarket entrance, possibly. Yes, I realize I have no basis for saying that.
Yeah.
I'm fully aware.
I just think that if it's your job to prevent these two men from kidnapping or murdering this woman, not being seen by them should take priority over what might look weird.
Yeah.
And in the chapter coming up, Tasha says that she likes having Midge around because she's someone she can have a laugh with. That suggests to me that they're having contact and they shouldn't be having contact when she's doing surveillance.
It's a fair point. Reluctantly.
We know she wasn't aware that Little John had taken the pictures. So she wasn't on super high alert. And I think she should have been if there was even the slightest possibility that the Franks could see them together. Because if they did, she's compromised. She can't watch the Franks anymore.
Yeah. Okay. That's a fair point that I can't actually refute.
Thank you.
Reluctantly. Although it does seem clear to me that this isn't even what Strike is primarily angry about. He doesn't even mention the possibility of her being seen by the Franks.
No, this makes zero sense to me, honestly, because he's way too good at his job not to recognize this, unless he knows that she was just watching the house and the Franks were somewhere else, and I just am missing that. But given that this is literally a life or death situation, in this case, I'd be pretty mad about this if I was the boss.
Yeah, I guess.
And I also just, I kind of don't understand when Dragon Robin are in the hotel room after he rescues her and she says Strike to him about this. I just don't get it. Like, what is she reacting to?
Well, obviously, she didn't want them getting canceled for being homophobic.
Okay.
That's how it works.
She also believes in true love. Just saying.
I just don't get it. Like, what is she reacting to? If I were Robin, my question would be, what happened? I wouldn't just immediately yell at Strike. I don't get it. Maybe I just don't get this.
Automatically assumes that he's in the wrong with the employees.
He's not. I just don't get it.
It's funny. Yeah. I mean, in the end, right or wrong, we can argue about all day. But for the purposes of the narrative, Strike had to overreact and shout here because he's the obstacle in Midge and Tasha's slow burn bodyguard lesbian romance. I mean,
oh my God.
It can't just be smooth sailing. They have to be kept apart so that each of them can realize how much they've come to care about each other. They have to like miss that electric charge, that unspoken thing between them. And then we get the reunion where they're trying to keep a professional distance, but there's all that pining and anticipation, you know? I mean, this is basic bodyguard romance stuff. Strike is playing his role here really well. A++. I really want to read this romance.
It doesn't seem like it was a slow burn.
I know that it's a fast burn compared to some people.
It's a pretty fast burn. It's only a couple months.
Well, compared to some people who've taken 6 years and still aren't together, it's fast. But
I think anything compared to that is fast.
For most romance novels, I think it would count as a slow burn. Yeah.
Okay. I'm happy for you that you enjoy this.
Thanks.
I don't have any type of investment in this.
No.
No.
Okay. Canceled.
I'm canceled.
Yeah.
All right. I'm fine with that. If that's the reason, I'm fine with that. I can live with it. You know what's also weird, though?
What?
Why was Little John there taking pictures? Was he trying to do more creepy things to Tasha?
Probably.
I fully believe, yes. And with that, any tiny amount of sympathy I might have felt for him earlier has evaporated.
Or was he also trying to follow the subcontractors to get dirt on them? Because that's what Patterson is trying to do.
Oh. Yeah, that's why Dev is not taking up his heroin habit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Good thing he didn't.
I wonder if that's what he was doing.
Heroin?
No, Little John. Maybe he was actually following Midge for Patterson.
Oh.
Do you think Little John was getting paid by Patterson and Strike?
Oh my God, he totally was.
Mm-hmm. We can't feel that bad for him.
Fuck that guy.
Okay. Chapter 76.
In this chapter, Robin finds a way to get Will alone and talk to him about his UHC beliefs.
Oh God, I need some wine.
Oof. Buckle in, folks.
And the epigraph. Here, every step, forward or backward, leads into danger. Escape is out of the question. And that's from Hexagram 29, The Abysmal Water. I'm pretty sure the first time I read this epigraph, I let out an actual, ugh, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We all know what this means. Robin is in all kinds of danger and she can't escape.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we're back at the abysmal is not a good sign. Not good. So the bit in the hexagram right after this epigraph says, therefore, we must not be misled into action, as a result of which we should only bog down deeper into the danger. Disagreeable as it may be to remain in such a situation, we must wait until a way out shows itself, which Robin does not follow this advice in this chapter. She acts. And it definitely does put her in more danger. But at the same time, it's also the thing that saves Will. So she might be bogged down a bit now, but in the end, she fights the abyss and she wins.
I think that we need a cult chapter cleanse at the end of this one to rid ourselves of the secondhand embarrassment from what's about to happen and the horror.
Definitely.
There's got to be a stronger word than because. Cool.
Yeah.
But I think that every cult chapter from here on in is going to need a C-cubed.
Yes.
Because shit has gotten dark and unpleasant. So yeah.
I'm sure we can think of stuff.
So the chapter opens with Robin helping decorate for the Drowned Prophet's manifestation. And it says that she's hanging banners on the outside of the temple that are white with dark blue waves.
I know the cult's whole thing is Dayu being the Drowned Prophet, but something about putting waves on the banners just weird. Me out. Mm. It's so much emphasis on her supposed death that's kind of weird. I guess that's what they do with most of the prophets. The only death they don't glorify is the Golden Prophet, who we know is begging for help at the end, right?
Oh,
wasn't she?
She was. Yeah. And that's a good point. For all of these prophets, the day of the manifestation of them is their day of death.
Yeah.
And the deaths are all supposed to serve as lessons as well. So it really doesn't surprise me that they've got the waves because it's a death cult.
It reminds me of Nearly Headless Nick's death day party in Chamber of Secrets. The UHC is having a lot of death day parties. Much more horrifying than some smelly food, though.
Definitely.
It says that Robin castigated herself for being paranoid that someone would knock her off the ladder and claim it was a horrible accident. And I was just thinking, that's not paranoid, my bois. That's what they did to Deirdre.
Right? I would absolutely not have been climbing any ladders around these people.
No.
Like, there's not a chance in hell. It's not paranoia. It's a very rational fear.
Yes.
And I was instantly terrified for her.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she'd have been able to like grab a banner on the way down and sort of Clark Griswold it, but I would not have wanted to risk that.
Yeah, this seems like a 100% rational fear.
Mm-hmm.
Killing someone and making it look like an accident or, you know, not preventable is like literally their whole brand.
Exactly.
So one of the American men here asks Robin if she wants to spear a bond.
Not with an American.
With an American?
An American.
And Shauna jumps in saying she can't because she's a spirit wife.
At the time, I was relieved that this gave Robin an easy out, but I'm pretty sure she could have come up with a good excuse on her own and avoided all the gossip and drama that this created.
Yeah.
I'm assuming Shauna assumed that this happened when she was serving waste that night, but she has no tact or sense.
My first thought upon reading this is just like, oh my God, Shauna, shut up. Why would you even say that if you weren't 100% sure?
I know.
Unless she's just a shitster.
And she likes to feel like she knows what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. She likes to feel in the know.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
What do you think makes someone a spirit wife?
I would imagine that there would be like a ceremony of some sort, because that seems like the sort of thing that they might
do. Weird stuff they do.
Does it have to involve his spirit penis?
If all it involves is a spirit penis, that's much better than the real thing.
Very much so.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe not if everyone's just willing to accept that Robin was made a spirit wife on nothing but Shauna's word.
Well, maybe it was just the Americans. Maybe they don't know the process.
Those dumb Americans.
I know.
Yeah. Though, I don't know. Surely not every woman that Jonathan Wayne sexually assaults is a spirit wife, right? I feel like he'd end up with a lot of wives.
Yeah, he really would.
Like Henry VIII with less beheading.
I would wish for more beheading in this case.
More beheading just of Jonathan Wayne.
Do it several times to make sure it sticks. Yeah.
Yeah. How many times was Nearly Headless Dick beheaded?
Oh, yeah. Or they tried? They tried to like cut his head off? I don't remember.
How many times was Nearly Headless Nick axe in the next 45 times.
That's Jesus. A lot.
That 45 times as the axe used was blunt. Unfortunately, it didn't sever his neck completely. I like how this is like it's a real fact.
Axe must have been dull as fuck. Oh my God.
This part that says that Robin was now constantly fantasizing about escaping through the woods kind of made me laugh, just because I'd been fantasizing about this since, I don't know, the very beginning of the book.
100%.
Yeah, I mean, you've been alternating between fantasies of Robin escaping and the usual strength fantasies that you have.
Which are?
Chest hair, upper body strength, the whole nine yards. I don't know you. Girl, I know you. Come on.
You have to include a special mention of Strike clobbing the shit out of the side of Tayo's face with some wire cutters.
It's good
stuff.
That's my go-to. I mean, thank God we're almost out so that your fantasy life can... regain its usual focus.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't want to have a
disjointed fantasy life. Mm-hmm. Single-minded. Yes. Eyes on the target.
Okay. So next, Robin is thinking about when she has to leave. The sensible thing to do, she knew, was leave via the perimeter blind spot on Thursday night when somebody from the agency would be in the vicinity to pick her up. As long as she left then, she'd miss the manifestation of the drowned prophet, which she'd now learned would take place on Friday evening.
I'm sure we all knew that this wasn't going to be this easy. I read this and knew something was going to happen that would prevent her from going to the rock on Thursday.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The dramatic irony is strong. Oh, she thinks she's going to manage to escape just in time to miss the scariest manifestation? That means she's definitely going to see it. And some real fucked up shit is about to go down.
Yep. That should have been the name of the cult.
Fucked up shit's about to go down.
Yes. I also knew it wasn't good that Tayo had returned without Lynn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my first immediate thought was, oh my God, where the hell have you taken and or done with her?
Oh, my immediate thought was, oh no, he's back.
That too.
Back again? Oh my God.
Robin then gets sent to work in a laundry, which I gotta say, out of all the labor people are tasked with on this farm, seems the least objectionable.
Yeah, I think I'd be okay with this. Although, I'm suddenly wondering, it's not really important, but I'm curious, are all the clothes mixed up and washed together and they just redistribute them? Or does each individual have their name inside their track suits and their underwear?
You know what? I was wondering this too, because surely the underwear and bras that Robin have brought with her must be too big for her now. Because she's lost like 30 pounds. It would be awful. So do they have a big closet of generic underwear to give out when people's gets worn out or doesn't fit? Like, I have questions.
They have to.
They must.
Yeah. J.K. Rowling, we're going to need to hear directly from you the logistics of how the UHC does its laundry in this book. I think I was imagining that they might do it the same way they might in a prison.
Wow. How does it work in a prison, Kent? I've never been.
Neither have I, but okay. I do know how to use Google, though, and that was very helpful in this instance.
No, I don't know. I think you have a secret past.
You know, Ken's
secret bad girl.
But yeah, I think that in some places, everybody just puts all their stuff in mesh laundry bags, and then they all get put together in these like enormous industrial size washers and dryers, and then it's given back to them.
But they don't have dryers. It said they had clotheslines.
Yeah. Okay, well, then just the washers then.
Because my fear is that they're just throwing underwear in washers and then just redistributing them. They're not keeping track of who's I know.
Yeah.
I mean, there are technically grosser things in this cult.
Sure. Corpse carrots,
rape.
Retreat rooms.
Yeah. But that's really gross and I don't like to think about that.
Sorry. I was just wondering. Yeah. I mean, do they give them new underwear every day?
That seems like that would get expensive. Is that what all the babies are funding? All of the clothes?
Oh my God. We had to traffic the children. It's to keep our cult in underwear. So that's their defense. I don't think that's going to go over well. Like, just go commando. Transition to a nudist cult. Like, what are you doing?
No.
You got to pivot.
Do you think Robin would have gone undercover in a nudist cult?
Oh, dear God.
Strike would be like, I'll volunteer. I'll go with you.
You need a buddy, Robin. We got to go together. Thank God I've been losing weight so well.
God, that's a lot of dicks.
All right. So many dicks. But it's on my wish list for book 8. As long as Strike's there too. Yeah. Undercover in a nudist colony before they get together. So it's super awkward.
This is probably the stupidest thing we've ever said.
Maybe the stupidest thing YouTube ever said, but I don't think it even cracks the top 10 for me, to be honest. I've said a lot of stupid shit.
That's true. We got to have some laughs in the episode, right?
Got to. God, when you have this much miserable shit, you got to find the humor somewhere. Otherwise, you're just going to cry.
Yep.
So next, Robin sees Will and Marion, and we haven't seen Marion in a while, but she's another one that's in love with Jonathan Wace.
Ugh.
This is when she starts yelling at Robin and accuses her of lying that she spirit bonded with Wace, and then she spits in Robin's face.
I was ready to throw hands.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This woman is unhinged.
Yeah.
This line right here, it says, something rigid and alien lived beneath the skin of the human being facing her. Something that couldn't be argued with. First of all, how incredibly creepy is that image?
It's good. Yeah.
It's good. It's such a vivid way to describe what this cult is trying to do, to erase a human being, to replace their individual self, their subjecthood, with just the doctrine of the UHC. It's hijacking. It's like they're pod people.
I felt like Harry when Amicus Caro spat at McGonagall's face in Deathly Hallows, like, let me at her.
Someone Crucio Marion.
Yes.
Oh my God. It's a parallel. I didn't even realize.
Mm-hmm. It says, Robin felt the saliva hit her just beneath her left eye and something broke inside her. Mm-hmm. Some last vestige of restraint. They're all mad. They're fucking mad.
I mean, as horrible as this is, I can appreciate that it gave Robin the reckless courage that she needed in this moment to ask Will the spirit bond. I don't think there would have been another way to get him alone. And I don't know if she could have asked him for this had Marion not pissed her off so much.
Yeah, this was the straw that broke her back.
It was the straw that broke the camel's with his head in the sand's back.
Mm-hmm. That's very true.
It was the grain of sand that broke the camel's neck.
We talked about how amazing Will was in the previous chapter last time in the kitchen where he questioned the Wace's hypocrisy and insulted Nolly Seymour. But I wasn't even thinking about how he had to go in the box. You know, it makes it a little less fun when you know he was punished for it.
I mean, although knowing that he was just in the box helps me to make a bit more sense out of this chapter, if that makes sense.
It absolutely does.
Yeah, because we know how frightened and ready to comply Robin was after she was punished. So it makes sense to me that this has had the same effect on Will, that he's pushed his doubts down and he's back to rigid compliance with the rules and refusing to think, because that's how you avoid getting put back in the box.
There's a line coming up that says that Robin was consumed with rage at Marion, at the church, at the hypocrisy and insanity. She couldn't pretend anymore. She was done with it all. And it kind of makes me sad when you compare it to how she felt the morning after the box, where she thinks she's just going to keep complying, because you're right. We're seeing the exact same thing happening with Will here, because all the signs of the real Will that we saw in the kitchen are now gone after the box.
Yes.
That is exactly what's happening for Will. And you're right, it does make his behavior really understandable.
Yeah.
It's hard to know how to talk about this conversation, because how do you talk about a conversation where one person is doing what Will is doing to himself the whole time?
So awkward.
It's so awkward. And it's unpleasant to read, and it's uncomfortable. I want to look away from the words, like Robin looks away from Will. The chapter's hard for me.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Oh my God, Kenz.
keeping the tone nice and
zero
low.
Zero pun intended. Well, it's not.
It's not. Exactly.
Exactly the point.
Yeah. The chapter isn't, I don't want to say the word hard, but the chapter isn't as hard for me as others, but it's awkward.
Yeah, definitely. It is very awkward. You know, it just reminds me of the lead up to the release of this book, whenever the Robert Galbraith Instagram account was doing like a promotional video. You know the one I'm talking about.
I know the one.
Mm-hmm. Where they're flipping through the book in such a way that you could pause and then read the pages. And I remember specifically landing on the page where it says something about remembering Will advancing on Robin, penis in hand, and then just saying to myself, like, what on earth happens in this book?
Yep, I saw the same thing, had the exact same reaction. What on earth? Yeah.
And also as a side note, I don't know if the Robert Galbraith team is listening, but I really hope just never do this again.
I really hope they don't.
There were so many big spoilers in there, like the stuff for Bijou.
I mean, that did make me feel a little bit better, but
still.
Yeah, I hope they don't do it again either.
While they're talking, Will is getting progressively angrier that Robin hasn't started undressing and keeps trying to talk to him.
I do have to say, I believe his anger is coming from fear of getting in trouble again, not that she's not having sex with him. I don't really think he wants to have sex with her in the first place. I think that's kind of obvious.
Mm-hmm.
He even says that you don't have a choice if you're asked.
You're right. I mean, but it's still a terrifying situation for Robin to be in because his desire isn't really what matters to the outcome. It's what he feels like he has to do. And the fact that he could overpower her, even as underfed as he is, because she's in the same boat.
That's true. But I didn't have any fear that Will would force her to have sex with him. The likely scenario for me was that he would storm out and tell someone that she was breaking the rules.
Oof, yes.
I do think it's worth pointing out that Will might also have to deal with some repercussions of being forced into sex when he didn't want it.
True. The repercussions for him, I mean, he doesn't have the threat of being forcibly impregnated.
No.
They do both face repercussions, but they're not completely equal repercussions. Not that his aren't serious, psychological impact, but there's a physical danger for Robin here.
I'm not saying that it has to be equal. I think that he's still being forced into sex for 4 years.
Yes, he is.
And I didn't have the fear that he was going to do that to Robin.
No. I was a little bit afraid, but you're looking at it at a distance. What you say is, yeah, he's just going to go tell on her. And that's as much danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's how I felt too, is she was more in danger of Will running out and running his mouth.
Oh, yeah. I feel so bad for him. Oh,
yeah.
Like, he's going to have to live with the image of that scene playing in his brain when he's trying to go to sleep for the rest of his life.
I know.
I don't know how he managed to look her in the face at all. Like, the last time we saw each other.
The thought of it is deeply stressful to me. As someone whose worst moments replays in their brain every time they try to go to sleep.
Same.
Oh.
I do love Robin bringing up rape, though, and saying he can't force her. Mm-hmm. I think this gave her the upper hand because he was not expecting that.
No, he wasn't. And this is very smart of Robin because she'd noticed that the sort of real world morality had been coming back to him before when he refused to sleep with Lynn. So she's taking that and she is slapping him in the face with it here. And it works. It does work to stop him.
In addition to fear, I think Robin really makes him mad by calling out Will's own contradictions when she points out that he cares more for Lynn than others and also Ching. She's really pushing his buttons on purpose.
She is. And it's necessary. She needs to go after his weak spots if she's going to get through to him.
Yeah, it's necessary and very well done. I feel like you can sort of see Strike's influence in how she was pushing his buttons a little bit. Yeah.
I like that idea.
I honestly don't remember how I felt when Will said he knew that she had been in the woods with the light. I can't remember if I was worried about this or if I had always assumed that he knew since Lynn knew.
Yeah, I think at this point I was racing through the book with my hands like half covering my eyes to get to her finally escaping. So I don't think I reacted to this at all. It's just one more dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Throw it on the pile with the rest of the shit.
I know. Yep.
That was my reaction too.
At a point, it's just too much and I can't handle it.
Your anxiety does in fact have a threshold.
It hit the threshold.
When Robin tells him that she thinks he's having doubts about the church, this is when it clicks for him. It says, Will's eyes narrowed. He let go of his penis and backed away several. That's a sentence I didn't think I'd ever say. He let go of his penis and backed away several steps. Did my father send you here? I was nervous about this because it's out now.
Mm-hmm.
I was having the Kill Bill alarm go off in my head, like, do We're fucked now.
I'm gonna pretend I know what you mean. Yeah. Oh. I think we should have our listeners play a drinking game where they take a sip every time I say I was nervous about something.
I'm gonna start using that drinking game.
Alcohol poisoning seems on the horizon if you do that.
Yeah. Please don't. I don't advise. I'm not a doctor, but I don't advise. You know, at this point, it's all over as far as Will's concerned, because Robin confirms this when she starts telling him that his family loves him.
It breaks my heart a bit after this when he says his mother loves him. Present tense.
Yeah.
And how clear it is that he loves her based on how angry he was about Colin lying that she was sick. Yeah. He clearly loved her. And yes, this is the thing that breaks through to him.
I know, it's so sad when he has to keep constantly correcting himself from calling them mom or dad. Because you can see that he wants to. It's such a struggle for him not to do it.
Yeah.
My feelings for Will are so, so complicated in this chapter. It's hard not to be angry at him when he's yelling at Robin, threatening her. I mean, when he punches her in the face. Not to mention the cringeworthy awkwardness of this conversation in the first place. I want to jump in the book myself and defend her from him, but it's just not that simple. It's not a black and white situation. He's just been put in the box and punished severely. He's terrified of getting in trouble again. And Robin pushing him to talk about the thing that got him in trouble in the first place, along with breaking the rules about the retreat room, it has to be terrifying for him. And on top of everything, he's just been told that his mother's dead. It's an awful situation for Robin, but I have a lot of empathy for Will.
Yeah, God, I can't imagine. That has got to be so overwhelming. Yeah, definitely not a black and white sort of situation.
Mm-hmm. The ending of the chapter is really where the bit of the epigraph about escape being out of the question comes into play, because Amandeep takes hold of Robin's wrist to take her back to the laundry. Ugh. And she had thought that earlier she was just going to run for it. And she can't.
She can't. At this point, I just wanted Robin to get a hold of a knife, stab Amandeep, and just run for it.
Sure.
Where would she get the knife? I don't know. I don't care. I just need her to get the hell out of there and start stabbing people until she's out.
Two words, carrot shank.
Carrot shank.
Yeah, continuing shit, girl. The murder carrot tradition. Yeah. Then she and Shanker would have something else in common, shanking buddies.
You know what? It's Shanker be shanked.
Yep. It's very true.
This part is terrifying because we don't know what Will's going to do. He's threatened to go tell Jonathan Wace about Robin being in the woods with the light earlier, and now Will knows she's been sent by his father. Ooh. Oh boy.
Yeah, terrifying. Mm-hmm. But we know now that he doesn't tell Wace everything.
Right.
Why do you think he doesn't? Does the possibility that the church might have kept his mother's death from him destroy the last vestiges of his loyalty to them? Or is he just being smart and revealing as little as he has to so that he has leverage if he needs it? Or is it just a general policy of saying as little as possible for safety?
I think it could be all of the above. Yeah. I think that Will is generally a good person. And he has a strong will, and that real will might be arguing not to say anything just yet.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, we have to do a cult chapter cleanse.
Yes, let's do it. Oh, thank God we're at the end of that scene.
Yeah. Okay, so I have one. I've been thinking about a couple lines in earlier books that I'm still kind of expecting resolutions to. Ooh. Something that might make it feel full circle, very elegant. One of those is in Cuckoo's Calling, where Strike thinks that Robin can't hold a candle to Charlotte. Remember that? I think we've talked about this line before. I would just love to see him think something like this about Robin.
Oh my God.
Something about how she's beautiful to him, or more importantly, that it's a kind of love he's never had before. I want him to feel that when they're holding each other or something.
Oh my God.
Think about it. Say it out loud.
So much. I need him to think more about how beautiful she is, just in general.
Yeah.
How much he loves looking at her face.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe something like how he can remember thinking that she wasn't as beautiful as Charlotte, but he can't quite comprehend that he thought that because the love he feels for her now makes her the most beautiful woman like he's ever seen.
Yeah.
Or something along those lines, you know.
Sure. I'm not picky.
I'm not picky. Yeah.
Oh, man. Now I'm just thinking of that bit from Troubled Blood when he's thinking about the message he was intending to send when he gave Robin the green dress.
Oh, boy.
When he thinks, you look gorgeous in this. Good. Uh-huh. And I'd like you to know I thought so when I saw you in it. Like, can he say that out loud? I think that I would die.
You need something like that. Oh boy.
Stop, drop, and roll.
Gorgeous in it. Oh my God. Okay. I would also very much like to hear him musing or talking about Kairos moments, comparing what he's had with Robin to the false Kairos moment with Charlotte. I know he sort of does that in the pub with Charlotte early in this book, talking about how, or was I just taking what was on offer? But I want some explicit comparisons for him to be like, I didn't even know what a life-changing moment was like until I met Robin.
You might not like this idea, but do you think there's a possibility that in the Hallmarked Man, before Robin says, I love you too, right? That Strike gets drunk and talks to her.
Oh my God. Like, oh my God, I would love that. Why would you think I wouldn't love that?
I don't know.
Why would you possibly think I wouldn't love that idea?
I don't know. But maybe, you know, he gets drunk and he's just looking at her like, you're so beautiful.
Jesus Christ.
Yes. Remember when I said I was in love with you? Just something like super drunk Strike, but this time just pouring his heart out.
Oh.
What on earth?
I'm sorry.
Would make you possibly think that I wouldn't instantly love that idea?
I don't know.
Oh my God. Okay. I need to, that's cleansed me. Now I can think of nothing else than a drunk confession parallel scene.
I think the reason why I was thinking you might not love is because I didn't want a drunk confession, but we already had the confession.
Yeah. He made the sober choice.
Now I just want the gushing.
Want the gushing. Oh boy. Yep. I'm on board. Write it down on the wish list.
Okay.
Do it. I need it. I need it, Lindsay.
Drunk mouth speaks sober thoughts. That's how it works.
Exactly.
Now what if Robin gets drunk before they work things out?
I think she needs a sober confession. She needs a
sober
well.
Moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to get it.
Yeah, you're right there. Oh, my God. Okay. That was cleansing. I feel cleansed.
All right. Are we ready for chapter 77?
I'm ready.
In chapter 77, Robin speaks with Jonathan Wace after her altercation with Will and sees a manifestation of Dayu.
The epigraph to this chapter reads, six at the top, bound with cords and ropes, shut in between thorn-hedged prison walls. Misfortune. And that's from hexagram 29, the abysmal.
I think this is re-emphasizing Robin's inability to escape. She's not literally bound with cords and ropes, but there's people everywhere and they're all a danger to her and she can't escape.
Yeah, you're 100% right. This one seems very straightforward. And again, it's the abysmal. Mm-hmm. Two in a row does not seem good.
We are at yet another terrifying chapter. Mm-hmm. After working in the laundry for a few more hours, imagine having to work in laundry after that.
Oh my God. I would deliberately sabotage everyone's shit.
Just throw in a red sock.
I throw in red socks. I don't know, put in too much soap so it all came out with white streaks. And fuck it all up. Fuck these guys.
Yeah. But Robin sees Will heading straight for the farmhouse and not even stopping at Dayu's fountain. What can we assume happened here? We know that Will didn't outright tell them that Robin was sent by his father. I'm assuming that this is when he went and asked to contact his mother.
Yeah, I think so. And I think he probably asked to see the letters they were keeping back too.
Mm.
I wonder if he read them first and then confronted the Waces about his mother dying, or if he straight up demanded to know if she was dead first. And that's why they think Robin might have said something.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think either one would be suspicious if they knew that he was just
right. And I was terrified reading this because I wasn't sure what he was going to do.
Mm-hmm. Robin ends up in a meditation session with Becca, of all people, and she's still using all of her remaining brain power to figure out how to escape.
Robin having constant thoughts of escape only to keep having it be impossible. It was a really good way to make me feel desperate and anxious. It worked. Yep. Mm-hmm. This is the part of the book where I'm just rocking back and forth in place and pulling my hair out, literally.
Oh, yeah, for sure. The anxiety was at an all-time high.
Yeah, I was over here trying to come up with a plan to get her out. I'm like, maybe you pretend to faint. You keel over outside. When whoever's watching goes, get Zhao, make a break for it, right? Or if they carry you to the farmhouse, then I don't know, set fire to something and then escape. Burn the place to the ground to get the hell out.
Good plan.
It's, you know, 4 out of 10, maybe I'd give it. It's not the best plan, okay? Yeah. But it's a plan.
Okay. It's a pl.
It's a pl.
Yeah. So Becca corners her when the meditation session was over to ask about her face. Because remember, Will punched her. So she's getting a bruise. It's swelling. Ugh. I have a feeling Becca already knows that Robin went into the retreat rooms with Will, came out with a huge bruise. I bet she was hoping to catch her in a lie.
I mean, it seems likely if it's been a few hours, then surely they've talked to the biggies about
this. The news has gotten around.
Yeah.
So like with most things, everything gets worse when Jonathan Wace appears.
I also think it's possible that he knows that she went with Will and he finds it suspicious since we already know that he's aware of her interactions with Will.
I think that Wace absolutely 100% knows, because there's no way that Will could have demanded to see his letters without Wace instantly being informed, right?
Yeah.
And then he'd have immediately investigated to find out what the hell's going on, what caused this. He came here to find Robin.
And he says, that's an interesting choice after what I told you about him during our last encounter.
Oh, and this is so terrifying, because a normal cult member, I'm being told that someone is a disruptive, would 100% avoid them, like the plague, right?
Oh, yeah.
So Robin seeking Will out after that is incredibly sus. And I think Wace now has a definite suspicion that Robin isn't who she says she is. Because if he connects this with Will suddenly wanting information about his family, knowing that the Enzers have hired private investigators before, Robin is royally screwed here.
I'm scared.
Yeah,
same. I'm scared.
Oh God. Stop making me worry that this is somehow going to end differently this time.
I'm also scared of that.
Yeah, I think the only reason she isn't punished now is because they're planning on punishing her at the manifestation.
Oh, God. Yeah, they're saving it. Oh.
Yep.
And the anticipation makes it worse.
Makes it worse.
Mm-hmm. Like the anticipation.
Yeah.
I couldn't wait any longer. I don't have the patience.
Robin then thinks that she's going to leave tonight, assuming that she didn't get summoned to Jonathan Wace's office at any moment.
I have to imagine she'd run for it and try to outrun everyone if this happened, right? If she got pulled to the office, no one would be there to drive her away, but what else could she do?
Yeah.
I'm getting stressed about it and didn't even happen.
It says 16 teenaged girls, all dressed in long white robes and holding flaming torches, were ascending the temple steps in the twilight. As the onlookers paused to watch, the girls positioned themselves in pairs on the 8 stone steps leading to the temple doors, turned to face the courtyard, then stood in silence, their faces illuminated by the fire. Each girl's eyes had been painted with dark shadow to mimic running makeup, which gave them a very eerie appearance.
So we're told that this is a countdown to the manifestation, and that the next night the boys will do it, and the following night the principals. I think this is the first thing we've seen the principals actually do, besides teach classes. Mm. I'm having a hard time believing that any of them want to stand on these steps all night and pretend to care.
I guess that there is one night in their whole year where any of them have to suffer mild discomfort. And then they get to nap the whole next day. It's a hard life being a cult leader.
Yeah.
Also, they've painted their eyes with dark shadows to mimic running makeup, which would not have been a 7-year-old.
Right. Why do they do that?
Just to make them look extra creepy. That is literally the only possible answer, to make them look fucking scary as hell.
Mm.
What other answer is there?
I don't know. It's weird. Yeah.
It's very creepy to imagine. I don't like it.
I wonder if they're going to have this in this show, because this is going to be so creepy.
I think they're going to go like ham with the creepiness and the cult and all of the horrifying things. Like, how could they not? It's such a good opportunity to do great television.
It's going
to
be good.
I'm just imagining the scene we were just talking about now.
Oh, I don't know.
They're going to do that. They're going to find some other way to rework it.
What? They might, but just not
show it.
They might show the hand
moving.
Yeah, artistically shoot it so that there's
could happen.
No. Yeah. Oh, that would be so awful. Oh my God. Oh, I so can't creepy. Wait for this. I can't wait for the adaptation.
Oh,
this
boy.
Is gonna be so good.
Okay, the shock she must have felt that she literally can't escape now. It's kind of funny because this is one of those parts that I just didn't remember that people are standing on the steps. I think it's a combination of the trauma I felt from all of this, along with how quickly I was trying to read. Even though I've read this book multiple times, it just isn't sticking in my brain, some of these details, because I was so stressed.
Yeah.
I also don't know how she didn't cry when it said that she locked herself in the stall and tried not to break down. I'm about to cry just reading it.
She should have let herself cry, though. It might not have made her feel much better, because there's nothing that's going to do that, really, in this hellhole. You know, but at least she wouldn't be expending energy trying to stop herself from doing it.
She gets to cry on Strike's shoulder soon, so.
Oh, God. Okay. Oh, you had to remind me of that.
I did. I felt like we needed it.
Oh, yeah.
So some of the other women are now in the bathroom, and they all spot Dayu, air quotes, in the forest.
Mm.
Do you think there was another adult with this child in the forest? Because I'm thinking if Robin had tried to escape, was there a chance that she would have run into Tayo or someone while she's attempting to leave?
Ooh, I don't know. I could see the cult giving a kid strict instructions to just go stand in the field until the light goes off and then to book it. And the kid a bang, because what else do you do when you're a kid in this horrible place, right?
Sure.
And it's not like they're worried about kids being scared or in danger at all.
No, I don't think they are.
And you wouldn't want to risk an adult getting caught in whatever spotlight. Because if they're close enough to keep an eye on the kid, then...
Yeah, I'm just thinking worst case scenario, I guess.
Worst case scenario, I don't want her running smack dab into Tayo in the middle of the woods. No,
me either.
At all. Ugh. I'm stressed now thinking about
it. I know.
Oh, she gets out.
Yep, it's fine. Yeah. She's going to get out.
She's going to hug Strike.
She's going to hold his hand. It's okay.
5 minutes.
And so many hugs.
Oh, he just sits there with his arm around her the whole time. It's so cute. Okay, sorry.
I mean, we need it.
We
need that light at the end of the tunnel at this point, because this is rough.
The chapter ends with Marion giving Robin a look of malicious triumph.
Totally the opposite of Dumbledore's famous gleam of triumph.
Right?
I officially equally dislike Marion and Vivian, I think. Maybe that's why I mixed them up on my first read, because they're both awful.
Yeah. I mean, Maid Marian is the opposite of Maid Marian. She's Mad Marian.
Mad Marian. I like
Mad
it.
Oh my God, she's Mad Marian.
Yeah. All right. We're at the end of the chapter. We have to do another cult chapter cleanse because, oh boy. Mm-hmm. Anyone have one?
I have one.
Okay.
Remember how Robin sent pink roses after Joan died?
I do. And
how touched Strike was by that gesture, and how even though the whole agency was on the note, when he turned away, he was thinking only of Robin.
I do remember.
And then how it stuck on his mind so much, he brought it up to her in Skegness later to tell her that those are Joan's favorite flower.
I do.
Just makes me melt. I think that Robin should put a single pink rose in her wedding bouquet or her hair when she and Strike get married, just to have Joan there a little bit.
Aww.
Also, I know it's not very cleansing to think of Michael Ellicott dying, but you know, just in case he
just
does.
Really want this man to die.
She's out for blood.
Just in case he does, can you imagine how sweet and supportive Strike will be with her if that happens in book 8?
Yeah, I'm just imagining him like coming up to Massim for moral support then just providing some of that really sweet practical kindness. I think that it might make Linda warm up to Strike some.
If he held her hand during the funeral.
I do think a lot about the possibility of Strike and Robin going up and staying at the Ellicott's house. Not necessarily for a funeral, but just, you know, the contrast to when she and Matthew are there and they're fighting. And
yes.
Because I want Linda to see them together and see that she's happy.
And see the difference.
Yes, see that this is the man for her.
Yeah, she doesn't have to take anybody's word for it. She can see it there.
I know in that scenario, they're already together, but you know.
Listen, I'm here for all of it.
All of it.
I feel cleansed.
All right, so that is the end of part 5.
Oh,
we are on part 6 now.
All right, so the part 6 epigraph, and this one is from Hexagram 29, the abysmal, forward and backward, abyss on abyss. In danger like this, pause at first and wait. Otherwise, you will fall into a pit in the abyss. Do not act in this way.
Is there any way that we can convey to J.K. Rowling how scary this book was? Does she know?
She knows.
Scary this is.
She's gotta know.
She did this on purpose to us.
Oh boy.
Mm-hmm.
But this is our last part in the cult, you guys. We're almost there.
Ugh. Hallelujah.
We are almost out. I think that this is falling into the pit in the abyss does make me think of the bottomless pool.
Yep.
And maybe also this is talking about waiting for the right time to leave, pause and be cautious.
Yeah, I agree. Two abyss chapter epigraphs leading in to a whole ass abyss part epigraph. Mm-hmm. I think we're all very worried at this point.
We are.
And yeah, you're right about the advice it's giving Robin. She's trying frantically to figure out a way to escape this whole part, but she needs to wait for the exact right moment to present itself. You know, even then, even doing that, she does get dragged down into the pit.
Yeah.
And then the way out shows itself.
Yes, because Strike is there.
Okay,
chapter 78.
In this chapter, Strike meets up with Andrew Humboldt, QC.
Oh, thank God it's a Strike chapter. I need a break.
Yeah.
I need a cult break. Mm-hmm. Okay, the epigraph. In the life of man, acting on the spur of every caprice is wrong, and if continued, leads to humiliation. And that's hexagram 31, influence wooing.
This hexagram is generally concerned with courtship and marriage, mm-hmm. the relationship between men and women. It says it represents the weak above, the strong below, and their powers attracting each other. And now in the I Ching, the strong is the masculine and the weak mm-hmm. is the feminine, which... But mm-hmm. I think this line is speaking to both Hanbold and Strike, because Hanbold has run after his caprice. He's pursued his heart to Bijou. And frankly, this has not turned out super great for him.
No.
And he's been humiliated, even though he doesn't know the extent to which...
Deserved.
Humiliated, yeah. And Strike briefly did the same thing. But he has realized his mistake. He strengthened himself, and now he's exerting his own quiet strength to sort of woo Hanbold to his side and repair the damage done, right? Which to me is very superior man of him.
He's got that superior man energy.
He does, the SME.
Yes, agreed.
The way that this chapter opens is perfect. It says, had Strike known what had happened to his detective partner over the previous 24 hours, he'd have been driving full speed towards Norfolk.
Oh, this makes me want to cry. The love of his life is in so much danger and he has no idea. But if he did, he'd be doing everything he could to get to her.
Mm-hmm. He would be battering down the door.
I know.
And she hasn't even gotten to the worst bit yet. Imagine what he'd do if he knew that she was literally locked in a box in the moment it was happening.
Yeah.
Like, Farrell does not begin to describe how he would be. There would be blood.
It's like that scene in Deathly Hallows where Hermione's being tortured and Ron's just screaming her name.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. It's just like that.
Oh ouch. That
underrated scene.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that energy though. Yes. Mm-hmm.
But it's so cute when it says, he rose on Wednesday morning, buoyed by the idea that he'd be picking Robin up the following evening, having informed his subcontractors that he wanted to do this job himself. He's so cute, buoyed.
No.
He wanted to do the job himself. He wants to be her ride, her knight in an old blue BMW, because he is her main man.
Yeah.
Am I going in hard on the cute shit because of what's coming up? 100%.
We have to.
It's necessary.
And I bet he also knows that after all of the shit that Robin's been through after the past 4 months, the one person that she's probably going to want to see more than anyone else is going to be him.
Oh, yes. He knows.
Not that she wouldn't be happy with seeing Barkley Medvedev, but we all know who she really wants to see.
He's her best friend.
Best friends. Oh my gosh.
So it says Strike has regained a bit of weight. Not that much, just 5 pounds. But he recommits to his diet, eating porridge for breakfast.
Good for him.
Have we mentioned that this is another in-book parallel between Strike and Robin? We have. That
they both eat porridge. Has come up. Yeah.
Those 5 pounds aren't the only bad news that Strike gets this morning, because he also realizes that Torment Town, aka Flora Brewster, has deleted her entire Pinterest account due to his questions. And then, to make matters worse, he gets a very early morning phone call from Lucy about Ted being missing.
As concerned as I was for Ted here, I was 100% convinced that this was going to be fine and someone was going to find Ted, because I knew there was zero chance that Strike was going down to Cornwall with Robin escaping.
No, there's
just no way. We've already said it. It has to be Strike. I knew he wasn't going.
That's how books work.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But let me tell you, Strike's fear that Ted had somehow wandered into the sea did not help me not be afraid of the whole Robin being thrown into the sea theory. No one lost at sea. I can't take it.
Oh, my heart can't handle it.
No.
Honestly, I'm still kind of disappointed we didn't get that. But you know what? We know they're going to a little island in The Hallmarked Man. There's still hope.
For God's sake, fools.
No. I swear to God.
No. Get out the spray bottle. Where's my spray bottle? No. Bad pools.
Oh my God. Let us all give thanks that Joe is the one that is writing these
books. I love that you treat me presumably the same way you treat your criminal cat. That checks out.
Strike is off to a meeting with Andrew Humboldt, who is Bijou's not-so-secret lover.
I feel like J.K. Rowling is re-emphasizing Bijou's motives here to get pregnant by Humboldt specifically, when Strike thinks about how expensive his place must be, and it says Bijou had had many lucrative reasons to be careless with her birth control. I mean, given the description of him, he has to have something to interest her, right?
Right. Sipping my wine, raising my eyebrows.
Yeah.
Does careless accurately describe it, Strike? Although I guess he doesn't actually know about the whole trash condom thing.
He does not.
That's his own fault.
No.
But in regards to the way that Humboldt's described, I love Joe's use of the adjective Hogarthian to describe him. For those who don't know, William Hogarth was an 18th century English painter whose satirical political illustrations, he did a bunch of them, they were so well known and so famous that the style literally inspired an adjective, Hogarthian, the style of the face. But that's an actual adjective referring to the artistic style that this guy painted satire in the 18th century. Nice.
Well, today I learned. Yes. I was wondering what the hell that meant.
You're welcome.
When Strike shows a picture of Farah, the woman who works for Patterson, to Honbold, this bit is so funny to me. It says, Honbold retrieved his gold-rimmed reading glasses from his shirt pocket, then picked up the phone and held it at various distances from his eyes as though the picture might transform into a different woman if he found the right number of inches from which to view it. Yeah, I can totally see it because I might have some relatives who do exactly this.
I do that exact same thing.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yeah. I usually do it for comedic effect.
Okay. Anyway, this was just really funny to me. I could totally see it.
This whole next bit is when Strike tells Humboldt that Farah works for Patterson.
I was kind of just relieved that he believed him and that seemed like this was going to be fine. You know, I was worried that Humboldt wasn't going to believe him.
Interesting, though, that Strike is exposing someone for basically doing exactly what he and Robin did. Shh. In Lisa
that
White.
Doesn't matter. Shh. We don't talk about that. We don't talk about Bruno. Is there any difference? Can someone please tell us if there's any difference in the law between what Strike and Robin did versus
what
Patterson?
Well, I guess Strike was bug a member of parliament versus a random lawyer's office. So,
yeah.
Don't know. It seems like they'd be in more trouble. Well, the difference is that they got away with it.
Yeah, because they're better detectives.
That's the difference.
Garrett Wynn is going to see this in the news and be like,
make his little face. Mm-hmm. So this line from Strike about Farah, where he says, acting's clearly her strong suit because she's not much cop at undercover surveillance. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, oh, unlike someone we know who is not only a brilliant actor, but also earned, what did Robin earn in her surveillance course?
I know the one that you're talking about. That is the Folsom letter of commendation.
Yeah, the one she kept shoving under Strike's nose. So cute. She's both a brilliant actor and so good at surveillance that she got a letter of commendation to shove under Strike's nose and for Matthew to be a dick about. So Farah does not measure up to the standards of the agency, is all I'm saying.
We're then interrupted with a call from Lucy that gives us an update on Ted.
Yes, they found Ted, but Lucy's going to bring him home and wants to know if Strike can go to her house tomorrow.
Oh, I know.
Listen,
a part of me kind of wanted to go back in time to when Strike would avoid seeing his family at all costs. I mean, I know that it's better now with the growth and the relationship between him and Lucy, whatever. But at the risk of missing Robin? No.
The one time we were hoping that he'd backslide.
Right? Backslide Strike.
I don't even think this would count as backsliding. I feel like the one time where it would have been okay to ask if they could do it the following night would have been, I need to pick up my partner after 4 months of being in a dangerous cold. I feel like that's a pretty good reason.
It's a pretty good reason. Most definitely. Mm-hmm. If he'd thrown in, also she's the love of my life and I really want to marry her, Lucy would have been shoving him into the car herself.
I think so.
And paying for the gas. Be like, go. Yeah. Get your woman, propose immediately.
Yeah.
I'll deal with this.
I cannot wait till we get to talk about Lucy saying, it's fine if you're not one for marriage. Like, come on.
Oh my God.
There's a line here I think we need to clarify in regards to Bijou's pregnancy.
God.
Sorry.
Bijou's pregnancy again.
I'm sorry, but it talks about how an awkward silence settled between the two men, given that both of them had been having sex with the same woman over roughly the same period of time, and that Bijou was now pregnant. Strike supposed this was inevitable, but he wasn't going to be the one to bring up the subject. So I just have to say, this is not saying that both of them were having sex with her when she got pregnant. It's just that they were both sleeping with her in March, and now she is pregnant. I don't want people to read this and worry about this line.
Yeah, it's a very good point. She did not get pregnant during the period they were sleeping with her. It was after. We know that.
We know that because of math.
From evidence.
And science. And math. And counting.
Ovulation math.
If there's one math I feel like we're going to be good at, it's ovulation math.
Yes. I feel like that's our expertise.
It kind of is.
It's our lived experience, if you will.
Can we please talk about this hilarious part where Honbold calls Ilsa Isla, because
oh my god,
if you don't know, there was a whole thing in 2020 when Troubled Blood came out, because in the audiobook Robert Glenister said Isla for the whole book, and we all lost our minds over it, just completely. Oh, yeah. It was eventually corrected and my audiobook was updated, but I read this part and I laughed out loud. I don't know if she did this with the intention of being funny, but it was funny.
It so was. Yeah, I think I would absolutely lose my mind if Joe did this as an intentional fourth wall break. Otherwise, yeah. It's a really hilarious coincidence.
It is. It's so funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm really glad that Shrike was able to tactfully turn Hotbold down as a client when he told them that their client list was full.
Right.
He just doesn't seem like a great guy, and Shrike definitely wants to get far away from him.
There was no way that Shrike was going to get even more involved with this whole mess.
Yeah.
And Hanbald's ranting is ridiculous. The nerve of his wife denying him access to his wine cellar. She expects him to go buy wine at the corner store like a peasant?
Oh, no.
No. I don't know what that accent was. That was my posh asshole accent, no,
it was,
I guess.
It was your cat voice. That's what was happening.
Oh, that was my cat voice?
Yeah. That's how Pools talks to her cat, by the way, if anybody's wondering.
Speaking of Strike not wanting to get any more involved with this whole mess with Bijou, I love the emphasis that Joe puts on this helping Strike get out of this mess with Bijou, when it talks about, you know, Strike had agreed to this meeting because he wanted to shut down forever the complications in which his ill-considered liaison with Bijou had involved him, and that he hadn't extricated himself from the Bijou humbled mess to plunge straight back into it.
Yes.
Bijou is not coming back, y'all.
She's goodbye, not. Bijou.
Bye-bye, Bijou. Like we said in the last episode, she served her purpose.
She did.
She's done so.
This pregnancy theory is as fake as something else.
you know what?
You know what?
I love the reminder that the agency gets glowing reports from clients. Five stars on Yelp. Also, I'm betting that one of those clients is Izzy Chisel, who I feel like has become basically their one-woman promotion agency. Because am I imagining it? Or have we had more than one person say that Izzy is the one who recommended them? You know what? It was Colin Enzer, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Who said that Izzy recommended them?
Yeah, it was.
I feel like Izzy's just constantly talking them up.
As well, she should. The Strike and Ellicott Detective Agency is the best in London, as we know.
I think she's also got a little thing for Strike.
Oh, she has.
Well,
a huge
I mean,
thing
that's
for
understandable.
I mean, who doesn't? Midge.
Yeah, it'd be a terrible match anyway.
They'd be horrible. They'd never work.
As you said, Hanbold basically rants about his wife for a while, and Strike is reminded of Barry Saxon. You remember that guy who came in to complain about Abigail? It says, just like the tube driver, the QC seemed perplexed and outraged that a woman he'd wronged might want to make things unpleasant for him in turn. Okay, so this is a reminder of Abigail, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what happens right after this? Strike says that he's looking forward to seeing Patterson in court, and Hodbold responds with a quote, "So you shall, and where the offense is, let the great axe fall."
Oh my God.
Get it? We're reminded of Abigail, and then an axe is mentioned.
I did not even catch this. I didn't even catch. I was so focused on the whole Shakespeare thing that has Joe ever been this blatant?
It's pretty good. Before?
She's like, "I'm giving you neon sign clues."
Yeah. She's like, "You get to book 7. None of you ever figure this out. I'm going to smack you in the face over and over." And we still can't figure it out.
It's a very subtle reminder of Abigail, but it's there.
It's not that subtle, really. Is it?
Well,
is it?
No, I guess not.
Which is dumb.
This is a fun clue for me. I really like it.
Yeah, this is really good.
But as you said, this quote that Hanbold says is another Shakespeare quote. Mm-hmm. So this time it's from Hamlet.
And first of all, I think personally it's quite funny that Hanbold uses this quote, because so in the play, King Claudius says this to Laertes, who is furious that his father was killed, Polonius. Now, Hamlet killed Polonius accidentally because the guy was hiding behind a curtain eavesdropping, and Hamlet thought that was the king, right? Stabs him through the curtain.
Yeah.
Very rude.
Quite.
And it feels like a fun little Easter egg because Hanbold, a cheater, is vowing justice against an eavesdropper after mistaking someone's identity. And he's quoting Claudius, a villain who is vowing justice for someone who's killed eavesdropping because of a mistaken identity.
Uh-huh. Is it Claudius? He's the one who killed the king in the first place, right? And therefore, this is all his fault. So it's kind of like, okay, Hanbold, you don't really get to call for justice when this is all happening because you cheated on your wife.
He is indeed. Claudius is the one who killed the previous king, supposedly, who was his brother. And then he married his brother's widow, the queen. And Hamlet is not very pleased about it.
I wouldn't imagine one would be.
He's not thrilled.
I did ask Kurt for his opinion on this, given that he's the expert.
He is.
Here's what Kurt said. These words are spoken by Claudius, the king of Denmark, the villain of Shakespeare's Hamlet. He murdered Hamlet's father, and at this moment, in Act 4, Scene 5, he is conspiring to kill Hamlet himself. Claudius's statement is ironic because the axe was the traditional implement of execution and therefore a symbol of justice. But Claudius, like Hanbold, is a guilty man. It is further ironic that the great axe will fall on Claudius himself at the end of the play when Hamlet finally achieves his revenge.
Kurt sounds so much smarter than me.
He sounds smarter than all of us.
Right.
Listen, I'm Shakespeare for the common man.
Right, exactly.
Gotcha.
So he continues, "Let the great axe fall" is also Shakespeare's way of telling the audience that the ending of the play that they've long been waiting for is close at hand. When King Claudius says these words late in Act 4, he sets in motion events that will take place in the play's very last scene. So too, Rowling will have Strike repeat Hanbold's quotation very late in the book in chapter 121, the end of part 8, just as he hits upon his new theory and tells Robin, "I think I know what happened. The detectives now know who done it, and therefore the great axe is about to fall. The end is coming soon." Mm-hmm. And then finally he says, "But what really fascinates me about Rowling's use of the great axe is that she exploits its symbolism, not simply of justice, but especially of delayed justice. First, Hanbold, like Claudius, will finally get what's coming to him after his long-term affair with Bijou. Next, Mitch Patterson, whom Hanbold is referring to when he quotes Shakespeare, will be busted after months or years of scheming to bring down the Strike and Ellicott agency. Third, the great axe of justice will finally fall upon Abigail as well as her father and the UHC."
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yes.
Delayed justice.
That is awesome.
Love it. Thank you, Kurt.
Thank you, Kurt.
Big thanks.
The two Shakespeare quotes in this book are really quite significant in their resonance with everything that's going on, which leads me to the fact that I now have a theory.
Lay it on us.
About the possible sources of the epigraphs in The Hallmarked Man.
You know, I cannot wait to find out what the epigraphs are.
I know, right?
Yes. It's one of the most exciting things for me.
I've got a theory. I'm actually typing up a two-part blog post. Okay. And I'm not just saying that. I have actually done work on this.
I'm so proud.
Thank you.
Good job.
I'm actually going to get this done.
Okay, hold on. This is going to come out in 2 weeks.
I'm going to commit on air.
Okay.
I'm going to have part one of this blog ready to drop on release date for this.
Okay. So today there should be a blog up for this. Go look, everyone.
And the next day, part two.
I'm excited to read it.
Every single listener has permission to at me on Twitter and shame me if I have not posted this.
Okay.
That's at PoolsVB.
Thanks, Kenz. Yes, it is at PoolsVB. So my thoughts are, we've talked about these two quotes of Shakespeare. I've had some thoughts about how Charlotte dies on Midsummer, basically, and how that connects to the play Midsummer Night's Dream. Mm-hmm. And I do see some connections there that I'm still working out. So we have seen some connections to Shakespeare in this book, a couple of really important kind of thematic connections and quotes dropped. And what if that is just foreshadowing for what's coming in the next book with the epigraphs? It's just a little hint that we have some very significant epigraphs coming up for a very significant book. I have things to support this. One, obviously, and I've talked about this already, that the title for The Hallmarked Man was announced on the Ides of March. You know, one of Shakespeare's most famous plays was Julius Caesar, from which we get the line, "Beware the Ides of March." I have more than that, though. Mm-hmm. I was thinking that there is a plot line in The Merchant of Venice, another one of Shakespeare's plays, that to me really resonates with Robin's journey and the constant mentions of silver that we've been getting so far in The Hallmarked Man. So we know that the hallmark refers to the stamp put on silver to show its quality and its provenance. And we've gotten a silver ship. So I feel like silver is a thing that's happening in The Hallmarked Man. So in The Merchant of Venice, Portia, whose father has died, said in his will that any suitor of hers would have to pick from one of three little caskets to try to win her hand, little boxes. And each would be made of a different metal. And the one who picked the right one would win her hand. So the caskets are gold, silver, and lead in that order. And they each have different inscriptions on them. Okay, now think of Robin. Think of the three men that she's been with, right?
When you say been with, you mean Matthew Murphy, and then Strike.
Yeah. Okay.
Not that she's been with Strike, but will be.
She will be. She's been with him in my head.
Well, same.
Three romantic interests.
Yeah. Three romantic interests.
Yes.
So the gold casket is the one that's chosen first. And it says on it, "Who chooseth me shall gain what many men desire." And the suitor who picks this casket is obsessed with superficial appearances, with wealth.
Matthew,
right? He picks it, but he fails. Her picture isn't in the casket. It's a skull. The romance dies. He leaves empty-handed. The second casket, though, I think that this book, Book 8, might be that silver book that explores why Murphy is not the one for Robin and gets rid of him.
Right.
But the second silver casket says, "Who chooseth me shall get as much as he deserves." Now, I don't know for sure because this is speculation, but I feel like we've had a sense maybe from Ryan that he's a little assured of what he deserves because he's a good guy. He's a nice guy. He deserves Robin, right?
Okay.
We kind of feel his possessiveness. But in the end, he's left, when he picks the casket, this guy in the play, he's left with a mirror that shows only his face. And he's described as he's looking at a fool. I feel like Murphy's going to be left feeling pretty foolish when...
Ooh.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, he will.
But he picks that casket because he feels like he's not one of those guys who only sees the surface glitter. He's a unique man who deserves Robin, and the whole world would be better if everyone got what they deserved. That's his thought process. But then, and this is what's interesting, the last casket, the lead casket, it says on it, "Who chooseth me must give and hazard all he hath." Hazard meaning gamble.
Oh, yeah. Aww. Okay.
Right? You get what I'm saying now?
He's risking it all.
He's risking it all. He's giving it all to her. Boy. He's been so afraid for so long, but now he's rolled that dice and he says, yeah. I will risk everything to have you. And that turns out that lead was the right casket. And the guy who picked it was the one that Portia wanted anyways. So happy ending.
Yeah.
And also lead is the metal that is transmuted into the Philosopher's Stone through the alchemical process. But I haven't worked that out because sure. You know, I'm not an expert. I'm just saying that this three casket thing lines up so perfectly with her three romantic interests. With the silver focus that we've gotten so far, wouldn't it be amazing if the epigraphs were Shakespeare?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I did a search through all of his works to look for like silver or hallmarks or the mark. I couldn't find anything relevant, but I have an explanation for that, which has to do with odd and even books and where the epigraphs show up. It's very possible that the Hallmark Man is not referring to the epigraphs, but in fact to something in the text because of even number of books. So
okay.
I'll explain all that in the blog post.
Okay. A little tease.
A little tease to go read it.
Yeah.
Part two tomorrow. Oh, this would be so amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if it's going to happen.
I want it
Doesn't matter. Fun theory. Can't wait for the I can't wait to find out what the epigraphs are.
Oh my God, same. And the caskets make sense to me. I'm going to need, obviously, Kurt's input on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just really love some Shakespeare epigraphs because there's some romantic shit in there.
Please and thank you.
That's my theory. Read it on the website because I'm going to finish it.
It's going to be out today.
Yeah. It's going to definitely be out today. Add me on Twitter if it isn't.
All right. That is a fun way to end the episode.
Yes.
All right, Kenz, what are we doing next time?
We are doing chapters 79 through 82. And in those chapters, Strike listens to Farah Navabi's dictaphone interview with Kevin Purbright. Robin attends the manifestation of the drowned prophet and is put inside of the box for punishment. Oh, God. So buckle up, folks. That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.